As I was saying, the Bible speaks highly of women. And in the first lesson, the overview, I tried to make sure that we understood exactly how well the Bible speaks about them. And I felt it was important to lay this groundwork for the series of lessons that I'm bringing forth, because without this understanding, without this knowledge that the Bible does respect and value the role of women in creation and in the church, everything that follows just doesn't make sense. And hopefully what we gained from that first study was an understanding that the common perception outside the walls of the church that the Bible is anti-women is simply not true. In the second lesson, we started our look at the songs and prayers of women of the Bible by looking at Miriam, the sister of Moses and of Aaron. We don't have very many passages about her, but in what we do have, we found her to be possessed of a fiery spirit and an ability to lead the women of Israel. But for all of that, she was mindful of God, and for the most part, she was supportive of Moses' leadership. We found that she's only one of five women described as being a prophetess in the Bible, placing her in exclusive company. And by the end of that lesson, we saw that it's important to celebrate success. Through her song, we saw that women can be leaders in the correct context. And we also saw the importance of a unified leadership where all parts work together toward a common good. This morning, we're going to examine the next woman in the series. And we're going to go to an uncertain time in Israel's history. We're going to venture back to the time of the judges, when Israel found itself in a seemingly inescapable cycle of S's. First, they would sin. And spending enough time in that sin, God caused an outside influence to bring suffering upon them. After enough time in that oppression, the people would be sorrowful and return to God, at which point he would send salvation in the form of a deliverer, somebody who would come and deliver them from the trouble in which they found themselves. At the point that we're going to talk about this morning, the people of Israel have already been through this cycle twice, at least twice, through the judgeship of Othniel and of Ehud. And I didn't realize this before the lesson, but there seems to be some controversy about whether Shamgar was actually next or if he is supposed to fall after Samson. There seem to be compelling arguments either way, but that's another topic. And so we will press on with the actual one. But for sure, the people had been through this cycle definitely twice. And under Othniel, they had been delivered from the Mesopotamians. Under Ehud, they had been delivered from the Moabites. And if Shamgar is in the right spot, he also delivered them from the Philistines. But then we get to the fourth chapter of the book of Judges and meet another deliverer, Deborah. And so I want to summarize chapter 4, and then we'll spend the bulk of our time reading through chapter 5. To summarize chapter 4, we have the narrative, the account of what actually happens during the time of Deborah in Judges chapter 4. We find that Ehud has died, and he has apparently been dead for some time, but during that time, Israel has lapsed back into that cycle of S's. They have been sinful, and as a result, they find themselves oppressed for a 20-year period by Jabin, the king of Canaan. He lives in a city called Hazor, which is just north of the Sea of Galilee. If you can picture in your mind the map of Israel, you have the Dead Sea down to the south, you have the Sea of Galilee up here, and then just above that is the city of Hazor, where Jabin, the king of Canaan, lives. And from there, he is spreading out his influence over the northern part of Israel, thanks to the work of his general, Sisera. Now, I found it interesting that Sisera actually lived about 40 miles away from the capital city of Hazor. That's quite a commute for a general at this time to go back and forth to protect the capital city. But from there, he has built an army that is notable for one chief reason. The core of the army that Sisera commanded was composed of 900 iron chariots. From our classes, from other lessons, we remember that chariots were like the tank of the day. They were heavy. They combined the power of horses charging at you with a platform on the back from which men could fight. They could shoot arrows, they could throw spears, they could stab with swords. And once they hit your line, there was a hole there, and they could jump down off that platform and begin fighting and exploiting the hole that they had made in your line. This was a powerful army. And for the chariots to be made out of iron and not just wood was impressive. That's a lot of iron. And these chariots may have been a ton or more each as they're rumbling towards you. It was an impressive sight and not one that I would want to be in front of. In the next few verses of chapter 4, we see that we cut away from all that hubbub in the north and go down to a single palm tree somewhere between a couple of cities down south, far away from everything. And this palm tree is known as the Tree of Deborah because guess who sits under it? Deborah. She leaves the city each morning, and she sits under this tree, and she sits there for the purpose of providing judgment for the people. And the judgment talked about here is the kind of judge that we're used to, somebody who hears cases and weighs them and figures out who is to benefit and who is to lose in that case. If you had a problem, you went to go see Deborah. And eventually she would become the judge that we read about in the book of Judges, the deliverer, the one who brings about salvation. But at this point in the account, Deborah is just a judge as we know her. She's also mentioned in this chapter as being another of the five female prophets. She's a prophetess. And apparently at some point, God comes and speaks to her and gives her a mission. He gives her something that needs to be accomplished. And so as she casts through all the people that she knows, as she weighs things to figure out what needs to happen, she settles upon one person, and he's a man by the name of Barak. And he lives actually further up, closer to the Sea of Galilee, and therefore he would be right there in the heart of Jabin's reach. He would be right there seeing everything going on. So she calls him, he comes down, and she tells him what God wants him to do, and at first he says, I don't think so. And it's easy for us to look at that and think, well, he was wishy-washy, but I think we'll see a little bit later on why he might have felt that way. Once he finally hears that Deborah is willing to go with him, he feels better about it, agrees to undertake the mission that God has set forth, goes back home and gathers an army of 10,000 from a couple of tribes. And then, again, this is almost like a movie the way it's written. We cut away to someone else. Now we have Heber the Kenite in chapter 4. And he is, we find out as a Kenite, he is a member of the people of Midian. And therefore, he is of distant blood relation to the Israelites. But as a Midianite, he would not have any reason to love the Israelites because his people would have been one of those affected when Joshua led the people in for the conquest of Canaan, and therefore displacing all the people in the land of Canaan. So he obviously had no love for the children of Israel, because one of the first things, what we find out he is doing is he's passing on information to Sisera. Look, they're gathering an army out here under your nose. I think you should know about it, Sisera. And Sisera, of course, then goes and gathers his army, and he says, we're not going to play this. We're going to put this down. So as we approach the second half of the chapter, we find that Sisera gathers his army and moves against this small army of ragtag Israelites that are trying to put together a resistance. And he's going to meet them near the brook or the river Kishon, which is in between Mount Tabor and Mount Carmel up in the northern part of Israel. And after all this preparation, all this uncertainty, all this craziness going on, In verse 14 of chapter 4, we have very simply, the Lord routed Sisera and his chariots. That's it. That's all we have in this chapter about the outcome of the battle. Thankfully, we have the next chapter, and we'll get into that more. But the battle goes so badly against Sisera and his army that we're told not a man was left. And it's so bad that Sisera leaves his chariot and runs away. Now, a chariot would have been probably the most effective way of getting out of there. You can bust through, you've got speed, you've got horses pulling you. That's your optimal way of getting out. But Sisera decides to leave all that behind and just take off on foot. And at first, things seem to be going his way. Everything's coming up Sisera. because he, as he's running, he comes across a campsite, and he realizes, oh, this is the campsite where Heber, the Kenite, the guy who's been passing me information and trying to make sure that I can do my job well, lives. And look, his wife Jael is coming out of the tent. Oh, she's calling me over. So as he goes there, he asks for water and a place to hide temporarily as he recovers his strength so he can continue to flee. And as she soothes him inside the dubious comfort of her tent, she gives him milk instead of water, gives him a blanket, and promises to watch out to make sure that nobody sneaks up on him. And once he finally falls asleep, she takes a tent peg and drives it through the temple of his head and into the ground. Yikes. I'm not sure why Jael would have felt compelled to do this, especially if her husband was a supporter of Sisera and of Jabin. But as I looked at the geography of the situation, as I looked at how he was running away, he was not running toward anything. There are two possible places that I found that he could have been running past to run across this campsite. One was up north of Hazor, which is the capital city of his king, in which case he would have gone right by the city and heading on to parts unknown. Or it would have been to the south of where the battle was fought, and he would have been passing by his home city. So either way, he was going beyond where he should have been going either way to be of further use to the king of Canaan. And maybe Jael saw this as treason or cowardice or something, and so she would have taken matters into her own hand to end the life of this cowardly general. And that is the battle. Everything that happens in this chapter is very succinct. It's very quickly stated. And we find in verses 23 and 24 of the chapter that on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. And there we have it. That is it. If we were looking for a super detailed account of this battle, we would leave this chapter disappointed. Thankfully, we have Deborah's song, and through this song, I think we will find the details that escaped us in this chapter, but we'll also learn a little bit about Deborah, and then we'll add some lessons that we can take from this, and then the lesson will be over. So let's move to chapter 5, and I thank Thane for reading verses 1 through 3 of this, because that set our minds on the topic at hand. But I'd like to read through the verses of this, and I'll pause intermittently to provide some commentary. Verses 1 through 3 again read, "Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, 'When leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I, even I, will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel.'" I found it notable that both Deborah and Barak sing in this song. Deborah could very well have sung it on her own, but she chose to incorporate the hesitant general of Israel's army to sing with her, and in that way she shared some of the victory with him. Also, she starts off with a very neat exhortation. In verse 2, when leaders lead in Israel, when leaders do what they are supposed to do, when the people willingly offer themselves, when the people following the leaders do what they're supposed to do, bless the Lord. Boy, you know, we could change one word in this. When leaders lead in the church, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. What a difference that willing acceptance of one's role can make in a group. Doing what you're supposed to do means everything. And because Barak eventually did what he was supposed to do, and because Deborah stood up and did what God asked her to do, because the people responded to a call, the Lord was blessed through those actions. I like to think that at this point in the song, as they're singing, when leaders lead in Israel, Deborah kind of plants her elbow in Barak's ribs, like, see, this is what should happen when you do what you're supposed to do, as they're standing side by side singing. But this is a reminder of why what happened happened. Let's go on to verses 4 and 5, and I think this is very important to our understanding of the battle. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured. The clouds also poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord, this Sinai, before the Lord God of Israel. The mountains of Seir actually border the eastern side of the Red Sea, way down south below the country of Israel. So the Israelites would be familiar with that area from their wanderings in the wilderness. They would know what's being talked about. This is about as far south as you can go. And then the field of Edom is actually north of that. So what we see here is a progression from south to north. I have a feeling that what has happened, based on the next verse, is that a storm is moving from the south, from the Red Sea, up through the land of Israel. And this is not a common occurrence. Usually storms come from the Mediterranean. But in this case, I think what's being described here is a storm moving from way down south in the Red Sea, up north, up to where the battle is taking place. And then we find here that the earth trembled, the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water, and the mountains gushed before the Lord. What we have here is an account of water coming from above, from the clouds and from the sky, and from below, gushing up from the mountains. As I read this, I was reminded of the account in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, as God floods the earth to bring deliverance, to bring judgment on the people who were so sinful that he wanted to wipe them off the face of the earth. We read there in chapter 7, verse 11 of Genesis that the heavens were broken, the windows of heavens opened, that the fountains of the deep were broken open. So again, we have water coming from above and from below to bring judgment on the people. In the same way, we have a judgment being delivered against Sisera and his army at the battle. And this is describing a torrential downpour in this battle. For whatever reason, God decided to bring the victory through a storm. And certainly that amount of rain coming from both above and below would have caused the ground of the valley where the battle was taking place to turn into a quagmire. And that is why the chariots were rendered ineffective. The iron would sink down into the mud. The horses would be straining against their traces and not making any progress. Let's move on to verses 6 through 9. In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted, and the travelers walked along the byways. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose. Arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. Then there was war in the gates. Not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord. Deborah is reminding the people, listen, you know how bad it is, how bad it has been. It's so bad that you could not even walk down the highway. You're afraid to take the major roads here because that's where your life is in danger. You have to resort to taking all these little squirrely side roads to get you from place to place. It's not a good time. It's not a good place to be. In verse 7, village life ceased. The way of life that we once knew is no more. Some translations of this verse actually say the rulers ceased. And because of that, I think that Jabin, king of Canaan, exerted his influence to the point where he took away any male leadership positions among the children of Israel so that they would not have that cohesive spirit. They would not be led by any one animating force. And so Jabin did his part to dismantle Israel's ability to resist his rule. Also, in verse 8, there's not even shields or spears among 40,000 of Israel. This, I think, is why Barak was so hesitant to accept a leadership position fighting against Jabin and his army. Because there is no leadership, he would be the sole leader. Because there is not even a means of arming themselves against a much superior force, there is nothing that Barak has to work with. So no wonder he said, no, thank you, I'll pass on that, until he found that Deborah was going to be there with him. Verses 10 through 12. Speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit in judges' attire and who walk along the road, far from the noise of the archers, among the watering places, there they shall recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers in Israel. Then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. In these verses, Deborah is looking forward to a time, now that the battle is over, she's looking forward to a time of recovery, of peace. There will be a time where prosperity will come again to the land. People will ride on white donkeys, a rarity. They will wear judges' attire. The men will return to their positions of leadership. They will be able to walk along the roads again, unlike in previous times. There will no longer be the sound of war. There will be places to water, places to gather in peace. She's looking forward to this time, but it's not just going to be about enjoying these times. It's going to be about reminding the people of what God has done, his righteous acts. That is the important, that's why Deborah did this. She did this to bring about a time when people could be reunited with the God that they once served and put away the gods that they had chosen to serve in his place. Verses 13 through 18. Then the survivors came down, the people against the nobles. The Lord came down from me against the mighty. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your peoples, from Machir, rulers came down. And from Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds? To hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan, and why did Dan remain on ships? Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlets. Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. I almost think that this part is where Barak took the lead of the song. He's talking about the recruiting process. He's talking about what he went through to gather the army that was successful against Jabin and against Sisera. He goes tribe by tribe against all those that he sent out requests to. Please send me your men. Please, I need somebody to fight against the enemy with. Some of them responded positively, sending help. Some of them decided to do nothing. I find it interesting in verse 13 also that he describes the battle here. Then the survivors came down. Translations are a little bit different in this particular passage, but the sense that I get is he's referring to his army as nothing more than a group of survivors. They are, if you're looking at armies for pomp and splendor, you're not going to look at Barak's army, because you're going to see a bunch of ragtag do-nothings that are perched up on a mountain and hoping that they're going to do something against Sisera's army. And he describes Sisera's army as the nobles. This is an army that has matching armor. They have sharp swords. They have chariots. They have training. They have numbers. They have everything going for them. And the situation for Barak looks hopeless. Let's take a look at verses 19 through 23. The kings came and fought. Then the kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away, that ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. O my soul, march on in strength. Then the horse's hooves pounded, the galloping of his steeds. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants bitterly, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. I think we are revisiting the battle scene here. As we saw earlier, rain is coming from above, water's gushing up from below. the ground is rendered useless for these chariots. But in addition to that, again, this is in a valley between two large mountains. The water is so intense that the river around which they're fighting, the river Kishon, is filled to overflowing and turned into a torrent, which again would sweep away those chariots. It would destroy the strength of Sisera's army. Nature itself is fighting against Sisera. We see that in the first verse there, the second verse, verse 20, about talking about even the heavens are joining in the fight. The stars are seemingly coming down to fight against this earthly army. God is involved in this fight, and he's bringing victory to his people. Then we come to the moment of the song where the glory that should have gone to Barak now goes to Jael, just as Deborah had prophesied. Verses 24 through 27. Most blessed among women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed is she among women in tents. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought out cream in a lordly bowl. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera. She pierced his head. She split and struck through his temple. At her feet, he sank. He fell. He lay still. At her feet, he sank. He fell. Where he sank, he fell dead. This is the pinnacle of the song. This is where everything comes to a head. This is the moment of glory. This is the breaking of any possible future resistance. An interesting note, as I was reading through different translations of this passage, the King James Version renders the Hebrew here as not only did she pierce him through the head, but then she smote off his head. I don't know what the case might be. I think other renderings make it so that his head was crushed in the pounding through of the stake. Whatever the case, it's like his head was removed from him in the process. Again, you don't want to mess with Jael. And then verses 28 through 30. The mother of Sisera looked through the window and cried out through the lattice, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots?" Her wisest ladies answered her, yet she answered herself, "Are they not finding and dividing the spoil, to every man a girl or two? For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments, plunder of garments embroidered and dyed, 2 pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looter." Even as Deborah is spending time thinking about what Sisera's mother must be feeling, in her own account, Deborah is saying that she is only worried about how much treasure Sisera is getting as he's destroying Israel. There's a disparity here. This was the passage that caught my eye most as I was reading through this, because in victory song literature, for a victorious people to be singing about what their victory means to the mother of their vanquished foe, that's very rare. I'd like to think that there is some compassion going on here. At the same time, I know Deborah is also disparaging Sisera and his family for their role in trying to oppress Israel. So I want to say that there is some compassion here, but at the same time, I think Deborah is also bringing down a curse on the very mother of the one who was fighting against them. And then finally, in verse 31, the last verse of the chapter, "Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength." And so the land had rest for 40 years. After everything is done, Deborah says, "Let this be the way that your enemies are brought to their ruin. Let this be the way that we are victorious, and let it be like the sun coming out after a storm." There's a lot I think we can learn about Deborah from chapters 4 and 5. I'm certain there are more things that could be learned than I am going to bring out, but that's where your study comes in. That's where you can make your own determinations. But what I found were, number one, that Deborah had what it took to be an architect of victory. She got a message from God, and it sounds like she was kind of left up to her own devices about how to accomplish that, using her skills that she used as a judge in earthly matters. She was able to discern character and ability and call the right person to the right place at the right time to bring about the victory that God said would be theirs. Being able to sift through character, being able to look through the heart of the matter and see what needed to be done, that's a great skill, and apparently Deborah had it. She was also very clever, because if we look at the song that she is credited with, if she is the author of this song, there's a lot of neat literary stuff going on here. Imagery, sounds, dissonance, assonance, all these things are working together in this piece to let us know that the person who was behind the words of this song knew what she was doing. First of all, in the last verse, we just saw that she compares victory with the sun coming out. And you contrast this with the storm that brought about the ruin of the army that Sisera brought against them. That's a neat duality going on there. That's some interesting literary work. But even more interesting, I found this in an article that I was reading about Deborah's song. In past lessons, Jeremy has mentioned what's called a chiastic structure. All that means is that it's shaped like an X. And so in a chiasm, you have ideas that are mirroring each other. At the beginning, you have an idea, and at the end, you have an idea that is similar. And as you move in, the ideas mirror each other until you get to the middle. And so you kind of build your way into the middle, and then as you build back out, you're seeing those same ideas repeated. That happens in this song. At the beginning of the song, we see nothing but despair in Israel. In the song, Deborah invites Israel to do something about their condition. The people respond. They gather as an army. We have the battle. And then after the battle, we start to see the reverse of everything. Now, instead of people gathering, God is smiting and scattering an army. After that, we have, instead of Deborah inviting Israel to do something about their condition, we have Jael inviting Sisera into her tent. And then finally, at the end of the song, where once there was despair in Israel, there is now despair in Canaan. It's a very strong way to tie together all the cohesive thoughts going on here, and that is indicative of a very strong, creative, intelligent mind behind this song. Deborah was something else. And so what I want to leave us with this morning is the idea of the lessons that we can gain from this time that we've spent considering Deborah and her song. This one's a throwaway, but I think it's worth mentioning. Don't mess with a woman who can set up her own tent. However, I found it interesting that even though Deborah was consulted for her wisdom, people obviously made an effort to come see her, she did not usurp the man's place. We find in Proverbs chapter 31, in the discussion of the worthy woman, that her husband sits in the gate. That was a common thing in the culture of the time. Men would gather in the gates to serve as judges. And so when people had a problem, they knew where to go look for that help. They didn't have to go wandering around, calling up numbers, looking at internet websites. They knew where to go to get the help that they needed desperately. But Deborah did not set up in a city gate. She set up away from all that because, perhaps in part, she did not want to look like she was taking over a man's responsibility. The second lesson: when those who are supposed to lead do not, you need to be ready to step up and take that responsibility. Again, Deborah was serving as a judge. She was doing it because apparently, from the words of the song, the men could not do it. They were being restricted from doing so. But she decided to do something about it. She did her part to help keep things going. And I thought it was interesting that as people realized that they had a problem that needed somebody else's arbitration, they would make the determination, I need to go see Deborah. But to get to her, they would have to pass through the city gate, the empty city gate, where once there had been men there to do this very job, to go see Deborah. It was a reminder to them every single time they did that, that things weren't the way they were supposed to be. It was perhaps a conscious decision on Deborah's part to force people to remember, this is not the way it should be. You're coming to see me, I'm happy to help, but things aren't right. Let us have that same mentality. When things aren't right, let's work to make things right. Her song, lesson number 3, has an emphasis on remembrance. Women, for whatever reason, you are very good at remembering things. Use that. Guys, we're really good at getting things done sometimes, but we tend to be very single-minded, single-focused, and everything else can just kind of sit over there until we're done with this thing. We need women to help us to remember what's important, what we should be focusing on, things that need to be done. Keep that up. And then finally, the focus of the song is purely on the agency of God in the victory that he provided his people. Barak is there. Sisera's army is there. But they're almost like pawns. They're almost like chess pieces that are inanimate and really not worthy of consideration. It's God's power that he evidenced through the rain, through the flood that destroyed the army, that brought about the victory that Barak's ragtag army, hiding up on a mountain, could not accomplish on its own. I think these are the lessons we can gain as we look at Deborah. I think we can see a lot of good characteristics, a lot of good in the character of Deborah as we read through these two chapters. And hopefully this will be a way of letting us know that if we just dig a little bit, we can gain a lot more from a passage than just a cursory reading will give us. I know we haven't spent time talking about Jesus, but we have been talking about a Savior. God provided a deliverance for his people that day. He delivered them from an oppression that they could not hope to withstand on their own. God still provides us that assurance of victory today through the death of his Son. His Son's blood, his perfect blood, offers us the opportunity to get out from under an oppression that we can't fight against on our own. If you're a Christian who is struggling with sin, you have an opportunity now to make things right. If you're not a Christian, but if your interest in God is piqued by what we've talked about this morning, God can give you everything that you need and more, so much more. You can become a follower of Christ this morning. And I offer you this lesson as a way of thinking about these things if you will just accept what God is calling you to do. Please come forward and talk to me as we stand and as we sing.